You're listening to the North Canton Chapel podcast. Thank you for joining us today. The North Canton Chapel exists to make much of Jesus every day to everyone. It's our prayer that this podcast will equip you to do just that. We believe that there's nothing like the church united together in gospel community. We'd love if you'd stop in and say hello in person if you're in our neighborhood. Our gathering times are at 9 and 10:30 a.m. Thank you again for joining us today. Let's listen in.
I want to let you in on a little secret. It's something that I'm learning as a pastor, as I kind of grow a little bit into that. Something I notice as a dad and as a husband. It's something that like I find very much at work in myself as I just try to grow up in the Lord. Little secret. Everybody wants the same thing. Everybody just wants to love and be loved. And I know that sounds like really basic, and maybe it strikes you as a little boring, I don't know, but I'm serious. I think that is actually one of the most base needs we have as people, to love and be loved. How would it change your thinking if you saw like the driving motor underneath most human activity, the things that we do, the clothes that we wear, the jokes that we tell, the relationships we cultivate, the ones we neglect, are all just really ways to get that need met. I just want to be loved. Despite all the places that we look, there's only one person who could ever love me the way that I'm meant to be loved, and that is God. So at the risk of massively oversimplifying the meaning of life, I think that's pretty much it. We are made to love and be loved. It's a need that I cannot shake. Only one person can meet it, and it's God. But there's a wrinkle in this whole thing. Here's the problem. We all know, kind of deep down, that we've all done stuff, thought stuff, that makes us unlovable. You know, like we've all got stuff sort of hidden back there in the closet, the stuff that we just kind of like, nope, right? I got that stuff, and you do too. And sometimes, like, I hear the lie kind of peek up again, and you might hear this one. It goes like this: no one would love you if they knew. And so you better run and hide. You ever hear that one? Or its vertical cousin, which sounds like this. It says, you know, dude, you are really testing God's patience, and one day it's going to run out. So if you wonder what it's like to wonder if God could still love you, you are ready for the book of Hosea. So this morning, we're starting our summer series through four minor prophets: Hosea, Joel, Amos, and Obadiah. I can't wait. We do these verse-by-verse series over the course of the summers around here to kind of provide a thread of continuity as you're bouncing through family rhythms and campsites. So for those of you who are like at Disney this morning, we're all like a little envious because it was like 40 degrees here yesterday. What is going on, Ohio? We'll get there. Anyway, here's where we're going this morning. Three kind of big movements. First thing we're going to do, I want to give you a little bit about the minor prophets, just four kind of quick things that you need to know. Second sort of chunk, we're going to read through the first couple chapters of Hosea together, starting in chapter 1, verse 1. And then really, last bit is what you need to do in response to the first three chapters of Hosea. So first, four quick questions and answers just to kind of get us oriented into these like minor prophet people and what they're about. First off, minor prophets, who were they? Minor prophets were a group of 12 books in the Old Testament written by 12 different writers. And the nice thing about all the minor prophets is they're named after the guy who wrote them. That's a little cheat sheet for you. They lived in Israel at a time where God's people were straying big time. And God, being discontent to let his people wander, sent in the prophets, these guys like fireworks, just blazing and burning, alerting the people that something had to change. So you'll get a sense of this as we go through this summer, but if you're looking for like light, uplifting reading, the prophets are not the place to go. This is like not Oprah's book club, like this is a little dark. The terrain is tough. You get the sharp rise of mountains and like the deep, dark shadow of deep valleys. Everything is more extreme in the prophets. Sin isn't just bad, it's terrible. God isn't just faithful, he's jaw-dropping. The prophets are kind of like off-putting people living in off-putting times. It's kind of why I love them. Second little bit of intro, what is a prophet? What do they do anyway? This is pretty important because it's going to help you understand what's going to happen to Hosea. And I say happen to because some of you know the story of Hosea already. And for those of you that do, don't spoil it because it's pretty fun. The prophets are a group of people, men and women in the Old Testament, who God used for two purposes. And I want you to get this. The first purpose is foretelling. Okay, foretelling basically just means telling the future, telling what's going to happen. God gave men and women specific insight into what he was going to do, foretelling. The second function of a prophet is forthtelling. So telling what's going to happen, but forthtelling is basically telling it like it is. Prophets are straight shooters. This definitely figures into Hosea's life. Again, just hold on for a minute. These two things in the prophets always kind of work in tandem, foretelling and forthtelling. Here's what God's going to do, and here's what you need to do in response. This is what prophets kind of sound like. And so if you're just getting into reading the prophets, if this is your first time getting into there, it's actually a really good question to ask as you're approaching the text. Ask yourself as you're reading something, is this something God's going to do, or is this something he's calling people to do? And it's a good chance that if you're in the prophets, whatever you're reading is going to fall into one of those two buckets. Just a study help for you. Third question you might be asking, why minor prophets? Why minor? I hate the word minor prophets, by the way. I wish we never got there, because the word minor kind of implies like diminutive or like small or less than, like, you know, minor traffic infraction. He played in the minor leagues. They minored in business, like, just a little thing. And if we're not careful, we could kind of approach these prophets with that idea, like expecting less somehow. Let me urge you, do not expect less from Hosea, Joel, Amos, and Obadiah. Maybe here's a way to think about it. If I gave you the option for two options for coffee, which one is going to pop your eyes open more? A triple shot of espresso served in a little minor cup? Or like a weak brewed thermos? That one. That's the minor prophets. Like, this is like rocket fuel. These guys are very potent, very small in length. But oh man, small and mighty. You'll get a sense of that in just a minute when we start sipping some Hosea together. So, last little bit. Last question, then we'll get into it. Why are we doing this? Why the minor prophets? That's probably a great question to ask. A couple years ago, I found myself in my grandparents' attic. Same house they lived in for 70 years over in Mogador, and grandma had passed, and we were going through all the stuff. You know how that goes, just going through all the things. And in the back corners of their attic, tucked under the eaves, behind a bunch of boxes, we found Grandma and Grandpa's letters that they wrote to each other while they were dating. And we couldn't help ourselves. I'm not sure what ethical choice you would have made in that moment, but we read them, and it was weird and a little gross at times, because I'm like, I don't want to hear that. But it was really awesome. Now, here's the thing. I have been over to that house hundreds of times in four decades of life. We've had, like, birthdays in their dining rooms. We've had, like, family Christmases in the living rooms. I have been 20 feet from those letters for over four decades. I had no idea they were there. That's why we're reading the Minor Prophets. Obscurity does not mean irrelevance. In fact, the dustiest corners often hold the most beautiful treasures. So, Hosea. We're going to be in Hosea for 5 weeks, the next 4 weeks after today. This morning, we're going to get you the whole story. Hosea 1 through 3, it's told in four scenes where God basically commandeers Hosea's life. And he uses his life as an object lesson. It's terrible. It's harsh. It's unthinkable, it's incredible, and it's really beautiful. So let's get to it. This is Hosea chapter 1, verse 1. The word of the Lord came to Hosea, son of Beeri, in the days of Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah, the kings of Judah, and in the days of Jeroboam, the son of Joash, king of Israel. When the Lord first spoke to Hosea, the Lord said to Hosea, "Go, take to yourself a wife of whoredom and have children of whoredom, for the land commits great whoredom." I'm not saying it any more times. It's weird. "By forsaking the Lord." And he went and he took Gomer, not Gomer Pyle, the daughter of Dibleam, and she conceived and bore him a son. Okay, so what is going on here? This is so weird. Like, hardly any introduction, no on-ramp. We're just like on the highway going 75 miles an hour. God just starts speaking. "Hosea, go marry a hooker." And he tells Hosea why. He says, "Well, because that's how my people are treating me right now." But it isn't just the content of God's command that's shocking as it is. It's the complete lack of context around it. God just says, "Go do this." God does this stuff through the prophets a lot. If you've read Ezekiel, there's some weird stuff in Ezekiel. He had Ezekiel lay on his left side for a year and then had him cook his lunch over a pile of smoldering poop as a way of demonstrating how bad the people's sin stunk to his nostrils. And every sixth grade boy is like, "Where is that VBS summer material? Let's do this." Like, that's just weird. The prophets are weird and they're awesome. But here's what kills me about this one. There's not one word of protestation from Hosea. There's no resistance. That's not in there. We don't get any sense that Hosea is like, "Hey, wait, God, I'm not sure you heard yourself just now. Prophets don't marry prostitutes. That's not really going to help my resume, God. I'm not sure we need to be doing this." I mean, let's put this into our world. Imagine Hosea's your neighbor. Like, he lives next door to you, and you guys mow each other's grass while the other is out of town, and then he comes home one day, and there's his new wife, and you're like, "Huh." Or imagine, like, he's candidating as lead pastor in a church somewhere, and the search committee's like, "Oh, yeah, well, bring your wife when you visit next weekend. We're really excited to meet her." And he's like, "Yeah, I'm not so sure you are." But we don't get any sense of that in Hosea. There's not like a hair's breadth between God's seemingly ludicrous command in verse 2 and Hosea's immediate obedience in verse 3. And I think that's worth considering for a second. Because we sing these songs here, you know, and all over the place. "Take my life and let it be all for you and for your glory. Take my life and let it be yours." You sung that, right? Or if you prefer the old hymn, it's the same sentiment, different words. "Take my life and let it be consecrated, Lord, to thee." I mean, we sing that, but we don't mean it like that, do we? "Take my life, God, use me." Okay, Hosea, here's what I want you to do. Whew. Okay. If that's what you want, God, I'm in. And I don't want to speed past this too far because there's this principle kind of lurking underneath verses 2 and 3 here. It says this: when you commit your life to God, you release your right to self-determination. You don't get to be in the driver's seat of your life anymore, which is good because most of us are terrible there. The only way you get the driver's seat back is you got to kick God out of it, which is not something that you want to do. And if you think I'm being too extreme, let's fast forward to the New Testament where Jesus says these crazy things like this in Matthew 16. He told the disciples, he goes, "Look, you want to follow me? Cool. Here's what that looks like. Deny yourself, pick up an electric chair," which is what that would have been, "and follow me." Or how about Luke 9, where he says something very similar? He says, "Look, no one who puts his hand to the plow," as if to say, like, you get ready to do the work of the kingdom, "and then looks back to check sure it's okay. If that's how we're going to do this," because you're not fit for the kingdom. Or the hardest one of all, in my mind, it comes from the Gospel of John. He says, "Truly, truly, I say to you, unless a grain of wheat falls to the earth and dies, it remains alone. But if it dies, it bears much fruit." And then in case you missed the metaphor, he says, "Look, whoever loves his life, loses it. Whoever hates his life in this world will keep it for eternal life." And then he just like nails it when he pushes it further. this business of like, come and die. Jesus just has this ethos of like, you want to follow me? Come and die. Follow me and die. How about that for like church growth principles? You'll never see that on a billboard anywhere. Come to our church. Learn how to die for Christ. Huh? This is a quick aside, and it's not the point of Hosea, but we have to see this for what it is. Discipleship is not me getting a little more serious about God. We've missed that. Discipleship is not me getting a little more serious about God. Discipleship is me giving myself completely over to God. And that's the people's problem in this era. And Hosea steps up, and he's going to leverage his life for the glory of God. The people's problem is that they're flirting with God. And God says, I don't want you to flirt with me. I want you to belong to me. And I wonder if God's saying that to you. Like, stop flirting with God. He doesn't need that. He doesn't want you to flirt with him. He wants you to belong to him. God commandeers Hosea's life to say, come to me. Things get even crazier, though. Scene 2, after he says this about the woman he must marry. Now for the kids. Scene 2, take a look in verse 3. She conceived, and she bore him a son. Now watch this whole thing. The Lord said to him, call his name Jezreel. For a little while I will punish the house of Jehu for the blood of Jezreel. We'll come back to what that means in a moment. And I'll put an end to the kingdom of the house of Israel. On that day, I will break the bow of Israel in the valley of Jezreel. Strange idea for your firstborn son. She conceived again and bore a daughter, and the Lord said to him, call her name No Mercy, for I will no more have mercy on the house of Israel to forgive them at all. But I'll have mercy on the house of Judah, and I'll save them by the Lord their God. I will not save them by bow or by sword or by war or by horses or by horsemen. So when she had weaned No Mercy, she conceived again a third time and bore a son. The Lord said, call his name Not My People, for you're not my people, and I'm not your God. So it's not enough that Hosea's marriage serves as an object lesson. Now God's wonderful plan for Hosea's life extends to his kids. Three kids, their names literally. First one, we said, is Jezreel. Literally means bloodshed. Jezreel was a city in northern Israel that had, over time, become synonymous with reckless violence. It would be like naming your kid Auschwitz or Ground Zero. Why would you want to do that? Hosea's secondborn, a daughter, literally means no mercy or not pitied. Our daughter Hannah is 15. I can't imagine a more tender relationship than a father to a daughter. And here's God commanding Hosea to effectively renounce his affection for his daughter every time he says her name. Thirdborn, it's another son, not my people. This one cuts even deeper because it's an annulment of the covenant that God made with his people at the time of Moses. You guys remember Exodus 6:7, right? Exodus 6:7, with the dust of Egypt still stuck to their sandals, here's what he says. I will take you to be my people, and I'll be your God. You shall know that I am the Lord, your God, who's brought you under the burden of the Egyptians. And now he's saying, well, let's follow this for a minute. Like, imagine the playground at school. How's that going to go? Hosea, is that your boy over there? He's so cute. What's his name? Yeah, that's not my people. Okay, like, he is your son or he isn't your son. It's like this theological version of Abbott and Costello, who's on first. Like, he is or he isn't. What are you really saying? You know, and Hosea says, no, he's called not my people, not my son. No, that's kind of strange name. Is that like a family name or something? Well, yeah. God told me to name him after you. What's going on here? This is theological realism. This is God's heart like convulsing within him where he's like, you say we're together. You say it. I know you say it and you do all the right things. Here's how our relationship actually feels to me. Do you have room in your theology for God to have an emotional response to you? But here's what's hiding under this too, is going to church doesn't make you a Christian. Saying the right things doesn't make you a Christian. Having a Bible, reading a Bible, memorizing a Bible, that doesn't mean you belong to God. Are you in covenant love relationship with the living God? That's what he's shooting for here. Same thing comes up in the New Testament. Matthew chapter 7, Jesus says this, "Not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, is going to enter the kingdom of heaven, but the one who does the will of my Father who is in heaven." On that day, many people are going to say, "Lord, Lord, did we not prophesy in your name and cast out demons in your name and do these mighty works in your name?" And then I'll declare to them, I never knew you. Depart from me. It's a very sobering reality that probably ought to freak us out a little bit. It's possible to have everybody convinced that you belong to God and he doesn't even know your name. So whatever salvation means, it must go beyond just rote memory and just doing the things. And it must mean actual, genuine, abiding affection for the true and living God. Now, here's the thing. If we stopped at verse 9, we could not say that God is a God of grace. But here's the thing about the prophets. Wherever you see a pronouncement of God's judgment, you will always see a promise of hope. You got to get that. Wherever you see the pronouncement of God's judgment, almost right on the heels, you'll see a promise of God's hope. So watch hope begin to glimmer faintly from the edges. Verse 10, "Yet the people of the children of Israel will be like the sand of the sea, which cannot be measured or numbered. And the place where it was said to them, 'You're not my people,' shall be said to them, 'Children of the living God.' And the children of Judah and the children of Israel will be gathered together, and they shall appoint for themselves one head." Well, that's interesting. "They shall go up from the land, for great shall be the day of Jezreel." You hear that? One head. Okay, so someone's coming. One king who will bring all of God's people together. God's covenant promise will stand. It will not be annulled. It will be fulfilled by one person, one head. But right now, people of God, we've got sin to deal with. And so God's word through Hosea falls back into the present moment, and the whole thing just gallops into this really vivid poetry. And just a heads up, we're going to read this. This is some really uncomfortable language. It's super sexual, and if you don't like it, I'm sorry. It's in the Bible, so you can email me later. I'm just reading it. This is sincere. So here we go. Chapter 2, verse 1. "Say to your brothers, 'You are my people.' To your sisters, 'You have received mercy.'" And then look what he does. He deputizes his kids to go talk to the mom. And he says this, he goes, "Plead with your mother, plead, for she's not my wife and I'm not her husband. As she put away her whoring from her face and her adultery from between her breasts, lest I strip her naked and make her as in the day she was born. Make her like a wilderness and make her like a parched land and kill her with thirst. Upon her children I will also have no mercy because they are children of whoredom. For their mother has played the whore. She who conceived them has acted shamefully. For she said, 'I will go after my lovers who give me my bread and my water and my wool and my flax and my oil and my drink and my and my and my and my and my and my and my. Therefore, I will hedge up her way with thorns. I will build a wall against her so she can't find her paths. She shall pursue her lovers, not overtake them. She shall seek them, not find them. And then she'll say, 'I'll go and return to my first husband, for it was better for me then than now.' She didn't know that it was I who gave her the grain, the wine, and the oil, and who lavished on her silver and gold, which they used for Baal." What's going on here? Let's imagine this. Imagine that your wife is cheating on you or your spouse is cheating on you, okay? Publicly, and everybody knows it, and she's not repentant, he's not repentant, and there's this giant fissure in your marriage or your relationship. And then you head to the coffee shop and you see her lover there at the coffee shop. You approach him and you say, "Hey, aren't you the one who's sleeping with And he looks at you and he says, yeah, man, she's a ton of fun. What's it to you? And you look back at him and you say, well, I'm her husband. And he kind of like sits back a little bit, tucks his chin, makes a fist, like not sure about what's to go on here. And you say, no. I know she's with you. I still love her. Here's $100. Make sure she eats well. That's mind-blowing to me. Like, I don't get that. I could not get there, but God does. God funds her in her infidelity. Why would he do that? What must he feel about faithless people to allow us to get away with that? What is he trying to accomplish? Back in verse 5, Gomer's talking about how great her lovers are, right? She says, oh man, look at what they gave me. They gave me my bread and my water and my wool and my flax and my oil and my drink. Oh, look at how great my life is now. I got money. And then God goes, wait. In verse 8, he says, you don't understand. You don't know. It was I who gave you those things. Can I tell you something very deeply ironic I'm noticing about the human condition, at least in me? We have an alarmingly easy tendency to receive God's gifts and then use them to get away from him. And I don't think I'm the only one that does that, but it's something that God's just showing me in myself. Like, how often do I see the goodness of the gifts and then completely miss the generosity of the giver? How often do I wrongly praise the thing which does not love me? And I miss the God who does. God is behind every good gift that you enjoy. And to show our thanks, we use them to fall out of love with him. I do that, and I'm sure you do too. We are such silent, subtle idolaters. Strange principle. Material sufficiency leads to spiritual complacency, leads to spiritual infidelity. I'll say that again. Material sufficiency, man, when I got everything that I could ever want, material sufficiency leads to spiritual complacency. We're like, God, I don't need God right now. I'm good. Leads to spiritual infidelity. God who? This is not a new thing. Back to Hosea. So God's had it. And so he goes on a seemingly reluctant sabotage. Take a look in chapter 2, verse 9. He says this, therefore, I will take back my grain in its time, my wine in its season. I will take away my wool and my flax, which were used to cover her nakedness. Now I will uncover her lewdness in the sight of her lovers. No one shall rescue her out of my hand. I will put an end to all of her mirth, her feasts, her new moons, her Sabbaths, all her appointed feasts. I will lay waste her vines and her fig trees, which she had, and said, these are my wages, which my lovers have given me. I'll make them a forest, and the beasts of the field shall devour them. And I will punish her for the feast of days of Baals, when she burned offerings to them and adorned herself with ring and jewelry and went after her lovers, but forgot me, declares the Lord. Can't you hear God's heart like just churning in there? Here's the point. God loves you too much to let you love anything more than him. He loves you too much to let you love anything more than him. He refuses to let you sit long in idolatry. Maybe for a season, he can't let it happen, though not forever. He will take back. He will hedge up your way with thorns. He will lay waste to. He will put an end to anything that's competing with him for your heart. He wants to be loved by you and love you. He doesn't like anything coming in between the two of you. When you hear that phrase, God is a jealous God, that. God reserves the right to remove whatever he has to remove from you if it means recapturing your heart. And that is a really hard thing to say, because that could mean anything. So here's what God does. Scene 3. Therefore, behold, I will allure her and bring her into the wilderness and speak tenderly to her. Let's stop with verse 14. Why the wilderness? Why does God take them there? Think of what the wilderness meant for God's people, like historically, theologically, topographically. Why wilderness? Looking back over their shoulder a few centuries, They had left Egypt, and where did God bring them? After their season of slavery, where did God bring them? Right into the wilderness. The wilderness is where the newly minted people of God became the people of God. They were never more God's people than when they were in the wilderness together. They heard from him. They learned him. They knew him. They loved him. And now in Hosea's day, seduced by all the glitz and the glamour of material sufficiency, gosh, those times seem so much simpler, don't they? You see what God's doing here? God is taking them back to their first date. Mandy and I met in college. We had our first date at a coffee shop under the L tracks, two blocks from campus. And it's still there. And when we go, every once in a while, if we're through Chicago, we'll go and we'll have coffee there. And it's like, it's just like I'm 19 again. Except when I see like the security mirror and I find my bald spot and I'm like, oh. Here's the point though. Topography and theology are linked deeply. The wilderness is the topography where God and his people first fell in love. This is where an anonymous people became his people. He's taking them back to where their relationship started in the hopes of reigniting that dying spark. And we use that word all the time, wilderness, right, in our lives. We go, oh, I'm just going through like a wilderness period right now. Like I feel like I'm lost in the wilderness, or I just came out of a wilderness period. Why do we use that word, that image? Why that? Wilderness is a stark place. It's a barren place where the less wild lovers we once chased are removed from our consciousness, where God speaks to us quietly and we hear no one but him. The wilderness is a place of singularity. And when he eventually leads us out of the wilderness, as he always does, we are led by the hand of a God we had once forgotten. The wilderness is God's place. So, back to the text. Here is God's plan. I'll lead her into the wilderness. I'll speak tenderly to her. There, I will give her her vineyards. I'll make the valley of Achor, literally the valley of trouble, a door of hope. There, she shall answer as in the days of her youth and as at the time when she came up out of the land of Egypt. And in that day, declares the Lord, you will call me my husband and no longer will you call me my Baal. For I will remove the names of the Baals from her mouth and they shall be remembered by name no more. I will make for them a covenant on that day with the beasts of the field, the birds of the heavens, the creeping things of the ground. I will abolish the bow, the sword, and war from the land and I will make you lie down in safety. And I will betroth you to me forever. I will betroth you to me in love and mercy. I will betroth you to me in faithfulness, and you shall know the Lord. This is a beautiful vision for what God's going to do one day. Let's hit it verse by verse. I want to hit this super quick. Verse 15, hope, not shame. Verse 16, fidelity, not faithlessness. Verse 17, holy forgetfulness. Verse 18, peace, no military parade. Verse 19, covenant relationship, not casual friendship. Verse 20, abiding intimacy, not flippant flirtation. And then now watch, God's going to get super specific. On that day, I will answer, declares the Lord. I will answer the heavens, and they will answer the earth. And the earth shall answer the grain and the wine and the oil. They shall answer Jezreel. I will sow her for myself in the land. I will have mercy on no mercy. I will say to not my people, you are my people. And he shall say, you are my God. Hosea, that object lesson that defined your life, everything is going to start to work backwards. The theological word for that is resurrection. All the barren places and broken things washed and new. All the dead and dying things healed and made fully alive. Those shameful places that we've all got one day covered over by love. That sounds pretty great, doesn't it? You going to be there for it? I hope so. So with that hopeful promise bouncing around in his head, Hosea is ready for his final assignment. And this has to be the toughest yet. Certainly, what comes next is the most striking thing to picture, because while all this will one day be true, it isn't yet. His wife is not home. She's still out there somewhere. Hosea's not sure where she is. He'd love to find her because he's worried about her and he loves her and he wants her back. And so God tells Hosea where she is. And God tells him what he's got to do to go get her back. The Lord said to me, go again. Love a woman who's loved by another man and is an adulteress, even as the Lord loves the children of Israel, though they turn to other gods and love cakes of raisins. Side note, that is not an opportunity to shun fruit. Those were connected to pagan ritual sacrifices. So if you're eating raisins today, you're not sinning. Just have to say that. Look what Hosea does. So I bought her for 15 shekels of silver and a homer and a lekath of barley. And I said to her, you must dwell as mine for many days. You shall not play the whore nor belong to another man. And so will I also be to you. For the children of Israel shall dwell many days without a king and a prince, without sacrifice or pillar, without ephod or household gods. Afterward, the children of Israel shall return and seek the Lord their God and David their king. And they shall come in fear to the Lord and to his goodness in the latter days. Hosea goes to the public auction right downtown, and there, amid the livestock, the property, and the tools, all the forgotten things of the world, the next item up for bid is his wife. And she doesn't look well. She's here because she can't pay her debts anymore. She can't do the things that she's used to doing. And she has no money. She is used up. Everybody in town knows her, and nobody wants her anymore, and she hates herself. And then looking through the crowd, she sees her husband. And Hosea steps up, and he raises his hand, and he says, I'll take her. There's not much of a bidding war. And the auctioneer's gavel falls, and Hosea pays the price of his wife's redemption out of his own pocket. The only line of dialogue is the reiteration of a marriage covenant. So I will be with you. And then he brings her home. They've got a lot of work to do together, to relearn each other, to get reacquainted. I'm sure the first couple of months are pretty tough. Now, I've got to be honest with you. When I hear love talked about in this way, Hosea 1 through 3, I'm not sure whether to laugh or cry or sing or be silent. This kind of love does not make any sense to me. And I think that's kind of the point. This kind of love is almost too good to be true. Rich Mullins, who is this wonderful singer-songwriter, sinner saint, puts it like this. Just listen. He says, people say God loves you, and I say, big deal, God loves everybody. That doesn't make me special. It just proves that God doesn't have any taste. God takes the junk of our lives, and he makes the greatest art in the world out of it. If God was cultured, if he was as civilized as many Christians wish that he was, he would be useless to Christianity. God is a wild man. And I hope that over the course of your life, you encounter him. If you want a religion that makes sense, I suggest something other than Christianity. But if you want a religion that makes life, this is the one. What does all that mean? Let me tell you why I love Hosea. Because I don't want a God who just tolerates me when I'm good. I want a God who pursues me when I'm not. I don't want a God who loves me when I deserve it. I want a God who chases me down when I don't. And thankfully, That is the God of Scripture.